Welcome to the Leadership Trap Podcast, recorded live here in Austin, Texas. In this podcast, we explore the conditions that lead to surviving and thriving in a successful leadership role. We examine the traps that can cause leaders to stumble, bumble, or get ambushed in ways that may or may not be of their own making. I'm Dr. Chris Petrovka, and with David Hewen of Austin WorkNet, we have a conversation with each leader that explores the traps that they have encountered through their leadership journey. Hopefully, it brings a new perspective to your role as a leader and helps you navigate your own way through the traps. Thanks for joining us. Let's jump into the trap. Welcome to the Leadership Trap. This is Chris Petrovka, and I'm here with my co-host, David Hewen of Austin WorkNet. David, this is a great episode. I was really, really impressed with Rob, and I'm curious, how did you meet? How did you bring him on as a guest?
Yeah, Rob Lynch was inevitable, I think, in our Leadership Trap series. I mean, here's a guy, by the way, he now runs his own consulting firm called Burst Consulting, which, of course, is a burst of energy, burst of growth, and so forth. That's a natural. I wish I'd thought of that. But he's a seasoned CEO. I mean, this guy has been an entrepreneurial CEO for four different startups. Each of them were acquired. And, you know, along the way, I've seen him get more and more clear-headed about what's important for a company to have the fundamentals in place. And he's a fundamentals kind of guy. He's looking at making sure a company can perform. They've got their business modeling in place. They've done the basic mission, vision, valuing, values work. So he does all this. And that's his nature. I mean, he's a sharp, impressive guy. I've known him for 20 years. He ran the last startup that I was involved in before I started doing my own gigs and running my own company. Clear Commerce was the name of that particular one. And I was so impressed with how this guy managed the board, managed the leadership team. He has a great mix of skills that he brings with him. He's kind of a sales-centric guy by nature, and he's competitive. This is something that we didn't talk about, but Rob, I don't think you knew this either, is a former member of the U.S. National Rowing Team. He's competed in world championships. A couple of years ago, he won the U.S. Rowing Masters National Championship.
Wow. So, did not know that.
Yeah. So impressive guy. He's tall. He's handsome. He has no hair, which you and I can both.
That's always a plus.
Totally, really. I think it is a plus. Yeah, clearly. So anyway, Rob Lynch is our guy, the CEO when it comes to entrepreneurial startups. So he's our guy.
And I would say if you're listening to this, about to listen to this episode, he's going to challenge you to ask yourself a few things. One, are you a toxic bee? Ask yourself, are you a toxic bee? Second question, are you the smartest person in the room? I mean, are you the smartest person in the room? And then the third question I really love that he asked, hey, would your presentation to the employees, to your employees, win an Oscar?
That's right. Yeah, he asked some profound questions. I'm not going to steal his thunder on one other question. Our listeners will have to stick it out. But when he engages with a new client and a CEO in particular, he has a fundamental question he asks about the leadership team. Remember that?
Yes. And,
yeah. So folks are going to have to listen in to hear that. But it makes so much sense. And he doesn't equivocate on this either. He doesn't give them a halfway answer. So Rob Lynch, founder of Burst Consulting, leader of multiple startups, getting them to the finish line. He's got a lot to say. So,
all right, let's jump into the trap.
Rob Lynch, welcome to the Leadership Trap. Glad you could join us.
Thank you, David and Chris.
So Rob and I do go way back. I took the leap from corporate to startups 20 plus years ago. And Rob ran the second startup I joined, company called Clear Commerce. And Rob, you've run startups 20 plus years. So, and you came from bigger corporate to get into that realm. I'm curious to get a sense from you, could you see yourself running another startup, or have you moved to a point of being more the advisor consultant at this stage?
Yeah, no, I definitely have moved to being more of that advisor consultant after the fourth one, I took a break. And when I was looking to get back in, everybody was like, oh, you know, you're a serial CEO, you're going to be back. I'm like, no, I'm done. Oh, no, you're a serial CEO. No, I'm done.
Yeah.
And I was done. So, I have transitioned to the other side, and I love what I do.
Yeah. Good for you. You've made it to the other side.
Yeah.
Intact. And with your expertise coming along with you, I'm curious to get a sense from you when you are brought into an early to mid-stage company. What are some of the assessment factors that you take into account? I mean, what are the early health indicators that you assess, and have they changed in your mind from, say, 20 years ago, the dot-com era? Are there different types of quick assessment indicators that this is a healthy company or this company has a lot of needs?
Yeah, well, when I first assessed, I mean, the first question I ask any prospective CEO is, would you enthusiastically rehire everybody on your executive team?
Yes.
And I'd be quiet and I just wait for as long as it takes for them to answer. Sometimes people will ask, well, can I take out the word enthusiastically? And my response is not no, it's hell no.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
I'm a disciple of Jim Collins. I think the work that he has done is just phenomenal. And it was in Good to Great where he talked about the first thing you have to do is who. You know, it's not where are you going to drive the bus, but it's who's on the bus and who do you need to get off the bus and, you know, who needs to be in the seats. Because he talked about, especially in that chapter, that things don't stay consistent or current in a company. And if you think about it, I mean, strategy, there is no such thing as going from point A to point B. It's like a sailboat, you know, where you're attacking. And the whole thing is that you've got to make sure you've got the right people that can adapt. And in fact, I think one of the quotes was that he had, which really I found provocative. He said, if you're climbing up this big, scary mountain, which is what it is when you're running a company, what's the most important decision? And his response was, who's at the other end of the rope?
That's great. It makes me ask a follow-up question if I could. That is, I think that question makes a ton of sense for that startup who's going through the transition and a lot of change, and their business model may look very different very quickly. Would you say the same thing to a well-established company where, and it's a bit of a loaded question, where I think there's a tendency to reward loyalty over whether it's the right fit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that question, it doesn't matter to me what your size is. I mean, at the end of the day, you're never going to be great if you don't have great people. I mean, Look at the teams that win the Super Bowl, the Stanley Cup, the World Series, the NBA championships. They're constantly retooling. And it's not that you have that ability of how much money they can spend. I mean, you always want to hire the best person for whatever that budget is. But no, that question does not change regardless of size.
Yeah, I find that people get pretty comfortable with pretty good and they're not willing to make enough change to be great.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, and David, you asked, you know, differences of 20 years ago. I don't know if it's so much difference or maybe my own maturity, but it's not just productivity, right? Because one of the things that I coach is productivity is only half their score. The other half is, are they living the culture of the company, right? What is their behavior? And in fact, who was it? The general manager, one of the Cubbies, finally won the World Series. Theo Epstein, I think, was their general manager. And he was written up either in Fortune or Forbes. And they asked him, what was the secret to finally get the Cubs? And he said, well, you know what? We actually went and traded for players who were not just great on the field, but they were phenomenal teammates in the locker room. Because so many times, especially in sports, you're going to put up with that superstar who's poison in the locker room. So, you know, the point being in corporate America is 50% of the score is productivity. The other 50% is a behavior.
Yeah, you know, I do a fair amount of leadership coaching these days, and I had an interesting situation in which an executive who was highly, highly valued in the organization, the head of HR was told, you know, this guy's a bully. And so she pulled me in to coach this guy, and I couldn't help but wonder, is this a coaching for recovery situation, or is it an HR investigatory issue? So when you find companies that have critical leaders on the team, yet they're exhibiting behaviors that probably have a negative influence to the culture, as an outsider, you have the luxury to be able to call this out pretty quickly. You can call bullshit and move on. So how do you handle those situations in which people say, no, this guy's hands off because he's critical?
Well, first of all, I would never take an assignment. I would never take a relationship if that was part of the conversation going in. Because there can't be any sacred people, right? I mean, if you truly want to get to, if you truly want to become great, I mean, you've got to be open to change. So it kind of goes back to what I said in the beginning. So I'm a big believer that you got to follow the core values. You got to live it, especially the executive team. I haven't had the situation before, if they were going to keep the person, then they got to get rid of whatever core value that individual is trashing. They got to get rid of it. They can't hold it up.
Yeah, it doesn't align. That's right. Yeah.
It can't hold it up as one of the five tenets of our behavior, and have this guy or gal trash it. Okay, you're going to keep them, then get rid of that core value.
Yeah, I see that so much, like where you just see the inconsistency all the time. And it seems to be when it happens to employees or individuals don't seem to talk about it, but everybody knows it, right? You just see it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, the employees know it first, right? Before we do.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, what in the hell were they thinking hiring that person?
Yes.
But the higher up we go, I mean, I use this term sometimes, what gets modeled gets done. So if you've got a top level executive that's modeling behaviors inconsistent with the values, one of the values, to your point, Rob, employees are pretty savvy and they realize, okay, this is the winning behavior ultimately. So I should look to that, maybe adopt it to some degree. So I kind of reflect it back to this executive. So I look like I'm part of the team. So it is a challenge when you've got these high influencers exhibiting behaviors that are inconsistent with values. And I assume you're in a position now where you can help companies identify those conditions or at least stake a claim to the values that matter.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I call them toxic bees, right? Because they perform. I mean, they're knocking the cover off the ball. But they're poison in the locker room. And I think that's worse than an employee that's not performing. So anyway, yeah, I do see it and have a lot of conversations. I'm like a dog on the bone with it.
Yeah.
So let me ask the flip side of that. When you come across some of these companies that you're working with or some of the leaders, what are some of the signs or indicators that get you excited about wanting to work with them? What do you go, wow, okay, this is going to be fun.
Yeah. Number one, that they're open to change, right? That they've tried things, they've read books, they've gone to seminars, and they're still not getting what they want. So they're open to change. But the other thing is that they're lifetime learners, right? That they're also very curious, and they want to learn, right? And they want to explore thought leaders, for example, that they haven't explored before. So it's really those two things, the openness to change and the willingness to change and to truly do that. And then lifetime learners are the two key things that I look for.
And when you're out, when you grab dinner, you grab drinks with some of these folks, and you're kind of in that dating stage, what are you listening for that tells you those two behaviors exist?
That they listen.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
That they're not just talking. Right. So, you know, if they're listening and I can have a dialogue with them, but I truly know that they're listening, I mean, that's an indication to me versus somebody that just doesn't shut up and they want to talk all the time and they want to be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
That is, and especially with the CEO, that is, in fact, in that dinner or the drinks, what I tell the CEO is, look, if you hire me, you will speak last.
That's good.
That's one of my ground rules. Unless I call on you and say, hey, David, we want to talk about weaknesses. You're the leader. I want you to go first. Unless I invite you, you speak last. And if you happen to jump in, I'm going to jump in.
Well, I hope it's just that they're picking up the check at the end of that dinner.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So that's another test, so to speak.
Hey, let me ask you to reflect back on the Rob Lynch of 20 years ago. You've had a 20 plus year run of running companies. So let's go back a ways. And what was a leadership trap? You're on the leadership trap. What was a leadership trap you now recognize in the Rob Lynch of 20 or 25 years ago?
Well, you know, it does get back to people. I was, when I first got into the business world, I was put in sales, went to sales school, learned how to sell, rose up the ranks because I could close business. And, you know, the saying of revenue, you know, revenue drives the business. That is true, right? Especially with startups, right? There's only two things that matter, revenue and cash flow. But I didn't have the appreciation on the people side, and especially the hiring process. So the thing I learned coming up the ranks is that the thing that separates the great salespeople from the rest of the pack is that they follow a process, whatever the company sales process happens to be. I didn't have that same, I'm not even going to say respect, understanding or awareness of the importance of the hiring process. So I really today, 20 years later, I talk about those are the two most important processes inside your company. Right. The hiring process and the revenue generation process, because we all know that C players lie. Right. They're professional interviewers. And then once they're in a company, I mean, if the company's small, they can't hide, but medium to large size companies, they can hide. So you have to have a hiring process in place that at worst you put a screen door, so to speak. So worst case, you know, B players are coming through that you have an opportunity to raise them up to become an A player. So, David, that's the number one, hands down, thing that I learned.
Was there a moment or an individual that particularly resonates with you where you kind of had that aha of, wow, this is an area I have not focused on, where you learned that trap?
In terms of the people side?
Well, yeah, in terms of where you realized that value is so important and you've been missing that in your career. Where did you kind of come to that revelation?
You know, I think it was, I already talked about Jim Collins. Pat Lencioni is another one.
Yep.
He wrote The Five Dysfunctions.
Yep.
But then I started going to leadership conferences twice a year. Mm. And, you know, these would be 2-3 day events, and they would have thought leaders come through, talk about, you know, people, strategy, and execution. And the people that were talking about the people, even on execution, right? All talk that theme and that message. So it was a constant like beating of the drum where it just became so obvious of, oh my God, so many people are saying this.
Yeah. Yeah. It gave you a chance to reflect and probably started going, oh, look at these people I've hired in this process.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, it used to be okay. You know, do I like this person?
There's a lot of hires
That's
done
the
that
worst
way.
Thing. That's the worst thing. I mean, I'm not going to name the founder, but one of the founders of the company was like, well, do I enjoy having a beer with this person? And I'm not even going to say he or she, because I've worked for both founders.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
Yeah.
Yep.
Me too, as a matter of fact. So Along these lines, have you found that there are some leaders that you immediately connect with, CEOs, now in your present state of advising companies, consulting to them, and you instantly realize, oh my gosh, this is the wrong leader for the role?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I talked about it to Chris a little bit, having that hypothetical drinks and dinner.
Yeah.
The smartest person in the room, right? I mean, they hire A players, but they put them in the background, right? And they don't let them talk. Uh-huh. They have all the answers. They want everybody to come to them for the answer. And that is a total bottleneck. You can't scale your company if you trained your people to come to you for, you know, the answer. So, I mean, that to me, that's a big, you know, that's a big flag.
Yeah.
And let me ask you a more nuanced question. Sorry, along these lines, Rob, because you mentioned your sales starting point in your professional career, and every CEO has a discipline that they start with. They were an engineer first. They were in finance first. They were in sales, marketing, whatever it may be. And I would suggest that informs them once they're in the CEO role. I witnessed you 20 years ago, and I knew, and my colleagues knew, that you were informed by your sales sensibilities. Do you see that as well? And is that potentially a hindrance for CEOs, that they may over rely on the discipline they bring with them, as opposed to being much more broadly considered now that they're in that CEO role?
Well, I think that if you get to that role, you have to have some level of awareness, and hopefully you've learned some level of awareness along the way, either in the personal work that you've done on yourself or 360s or whatever it is, you know, getting the feedback. But I think it's really important so that if you have a strength, that you then surround yourself with people that, you know, have strengths in those other areas. So that, and if that's your question, so that the company is not too, you know, lopsided because a CEO is strong in sales or strong in, you know, engineering or something like that. I think it is really important to make sure that you go find people like yourself, great in a certain discipline, because you want to be able to have healthy debates, you know, around the table.
And you know, your comment reminds me of one of your blog series was on the discomfort zone. And you talked about, right, the encouraging leaders to get out of that comfort zone, to be comfortable with areas and think about those leaders changing that you've talked about and how they evolve over time. Could you share a little bit about some of your advice for some of these successful leaders who are successful because, hey, they're doing what they're doing and it's working, and they know that they probably need to get themselves a little uncomfortable, but they can't quite make that leap. What do they do?
Yeah. I think this applies to me. I mean, I think the first thing is to you have to become more human. I really, and especially today, the CEO has got to become more human and become real and show empathy and have feelings and be able to say, I have no idea, right? Or I'm nervous, or I made a mistake. And I know myself early on, you know, I wasn't trained that way, right? I was trained to be stoic and not show feelings. And, but so I went through that discomfort zone and learned to open up. And so that's a big thing. And that's the thing that I talk to my clients about. And even when you're having conversations, you know, with your, and they can be tough conversations or somebody's not. I mean, the thing I've learned personally is that you can have the hardest conversation, but if you say it with kindness, I mean, it just totally changes the dynamic of that conversation, of that relationship or something like that. So if I have CEOs that remind me of myself, where I was certainly rough around the edges, I talk about that. I talk about my own personal experience and that you do need to come from a place of kindness. You can still, the plan, the plan is the plan is the plan, but you can get there through kindness and compassion, as opposed to, making people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. And when I'm talking to leaders, a lot of times, I will encourage them to first really focus on observing their own behaviors, watching how their own actions are, and make subtle changes. They don't have to be dramatic if you're going to try to make that shift, because some of them are afraid of getting uncomfortable, or, wow, my employees will really think it's really odd that I'm acting differently. It's not about showing up and being an entirely different person the next day.
Yeah. And even something is, because I do this with some of my clients when I see it. So if they are the smartest person in the room and they want to have all the answers, I just say to them, look, you have to speak last, yeah. Right? Or run an entire staff meeting by never answering a question, right? Don't give the answer. Answer the question by asking a question. Well, what do you think, David? Right? And see if you can get through an entire staff meeting by not telling people what to do. Instead, so those would be subtle changes. But it is interesting, though. They run a couple of staff meetings that way. The executive team is like, whoa.
Yeah.
They're sort of gauging, is this real? Is he testing us?
Did he just read a book?
Did he just read a book? Did he suddenly take on a mentor or coach? Did you take on a mentor or coach, by the way, Rob? I can't recall you ever discussing this in our early days together all those years ago. Did you seek out a mentor purposely back then?
You know, David, I think I had the best one in Jimmy Trabig. Mm. I mean, here's a guy who took Tandem from a paper napkin to $5 billion. And the guy stayed chairman, right, before it was bought out by Compaq. And I remember I would go to him. And the wisdom was just unbelievable. And I would go to him with an issue and he would just start laughing. And he's like, well, Rob, I have, I think, 13 examples. Which one would you like? And it's like, I have no idea. Just wow. Give me one. But I think the best one, and I use this all the time, I call it the Jimmy Trabig challenge to my CEOs. Because I remember when I would give at the all hands meetings, and Jimmy used to say to me, Rob, you got to touch their feelings, right? You got to write the all hands script as if it's an Oscar performing, Oscar delivering performance or something like that. I remember, trying to do that and, or talking about the strategy of the company, whatever it is. And then after the meeting, going to the lunchroom, asking people questions. And, whenever I asked them a question, it always seemed that everybody would be taking a bite out of the sandwich at the same time. Kind of like, instead of synchronized swimming, it'd be synchronized eating. I'm thinking, okay, what's going on here? And I remember getting frustrated and I went to Jimmy, and Jimmy said to me, Rob, until they start to repeat back to you your words, your phraseology, your act, whatever it is, they haven't heard it. So I don't care if it takes you 1,000 times, they haven't heard it. You're not saying enough. And that's, to me, that's the Jimmy Trabig challenge. What I say to the CEOs is, I don't care if you said it once or 12 times, until they start to say it back to you, they haven't heard it.
Yeah, I love it. We've had Jimmy on as a guest, and so we've had the pleasure of speaking with him. And so I hopefully if our listeners have not listened to our conversation with Jimmy, you should. Now you've got the endorsement here.
it was a gift having him.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, what was the term, Chris, that you were referring to with Jimmy, which he didn't have an instant recollection on, but what was it that he became known for?
It was the Jimmy Trabig Challenge. That was it. I mean, I've heard about it.
Okay.
I've seen other people write about it. And I asked him, he couldn't remember at the time. It was almost like he was so humble that he was just like, oh yeah, I'm not sure. Kind of like, I'm sure a lot of people have said a lot of things about me. It was just very casual. Wow. And I was like, it's actually quite impressive.
Yeah. So Rob, you had your own set of Jimmy Trabig challenges that you could take on. Let me ask you this. The employees that you run across now in the companies that you serve, and employees that you just generally run across, what are their motivators these days?
It's where the company is headed, right? Like, what is the, what's the purpose of the company? What good is the company doing? They want to have some kind of work-life balance, right? They don't want to be working, 80 hours a week. They do want to see that the company is performing, so that, you know, that is a motivator. That's a motivation to them as well. But it's not like the way that it used to be, where, you know, everything was so focused on performance. That's a big change. And I guess the other thing that motivates them, I talked about it earlier, is they want to be able to talk to their CEO, right, and have real conversations and have the sense that the CEO is telling them the truth.
Yeah. I follow on question to that. I'm curious, with the different leaders you're working with in the startups or other companies, how have you seen their behavior change over just the past 18 months, given everything going on between the COVID and the Black Lives Matter movement? And I have to believe you've seen some changes in the conversations you've had with them.
It's huge. Yeah. It's huge, because all of them have had to look at, okay, what do I need to do here? Right. And what do I also need to do standing up for my employees as the, you know, as the leader of this company? So in a way, it has really taken them, have steps of becoming, I use the phrase, you know, more real or more human. Maybe there's a better way of saying that. I don't mean that in a derogatory manner. Mm-hmm. But they having to take a look at what's going on in the outside world. Where do I take a stance? Where do I not take a stance? But really I call them real conversations, unscripted conversations with their employees, and their employees just, you know, are really appreciating that, you know, so much more.
Yeah. I've found myself, I think about and reflecting on this 2 years ago, the companies that I engage with or work with, whether I'm buying or whether I'm coaching or doing or any business with, I never thought about thinking about, I wonder who they're investing in. What politicians have they donated to? What causes have they donated to? These are things I think about now. And I imagine employees are thinking about these sort of things as well, which have to be impacting the leaders that we're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. And, it's certainly putting some of them in uncomfortable situations. Yeah. But it's the world that we live in.
It's one of the fastest rising indicators for this incoming generation of workers is around, does a company invest in social good? Does it purposely have its impact in the community it serves or in causes that it defines? This is more of an emphasis we've come to learn through just the work of the industry press, that this generation of employees hold their companies accountable for making a difference. Have you noticed that change as well, Rob?
Oh yeah, I have. And as you were saying that, David, and it's not just the employees, but those companies, those public companies that have the boards.
Yeah.
They have gotten so much more involved, right? You take a look at, what happened with Boeing, what happened with Wells Fargo, where it used to be that the board would basically, you know, take whatever came through the eyes of the CEO, whatever the CEO would say, they would take that. And they're not doing that anymore. I mean, they can't afford to do that. They have to know. It's huge risk now that a board doesn't know, you know, what's going on inside the company. And it can't just be, you know, what comes out of the mouth of the CEO, whatever the CEO writes to them. So it's on both. It's from the employee side, but for public companies, it's also, you know, from the top down from the board side.
Yeah, let's scale this down to small companies again, just for the fun of it. We'll make it a bit of a dilemma question for you. So, and we may want to expand on this discussion. There are extremely active boards. And then those who, this is one thing I really respected about you, Rob, is I felt you were able to manage the interests of the board with arm's length, and they tended to trust your integrity, that they knew you were shooting them straight, right, that they came to feel like between you and your CFO, whoever it was at that time, they had a good sense of the company. But there are some really active boards. So let me throw out a dilemma question for you. We like to do this with some of our guests. We've used this before with folks who have a CEO background. So let's say you're a CEO or you're advising a CEO and they get another round of funding and it's a pretty significant one. And as a result, the lead investor now takes a board seat. And that investor immediately comes in and makes a determination that one executive needs to go for whatever reason. Maybe they want to replace him with their own personal preferred person in that role. So the lead investor comes in and says, I've taken a quick look at your, a cursory look at your executive team. Your head of marketing needs to go. And from your standpoint, this is a critical person. They have the keys to the kingdom. They have a level of expertise. They have a trust among the executives. What do you do in that sort of condition with your new lead investor on the board seat?
Well, first of all, to your point, you do have to be able to, you know, manage your board because it's a way of losing your company if you don't.
Yeah.
If that marketing executive is truly an A player, then I'm gonna go to the mat with that lead investor on that marketing person. Everybody's entitled to their opinion. And yes, they're the lead investor, but if I think that marketing play is an A player, then I'm going to want to understand, you know, from a factual standpoint, what is it that the lead investor is thinking that, you know, the person is weak, or because maybe I've got a blind spot too. But I'm going to go to bat for that, you know, that particular executive. You know, if I've had a question about the executive and then somebody comes in and says the same thing, I mean, I would still have a conversation. Okay, what are you seeing? And if we're aligned on that, then I'd probably go make the change because I had a question too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. You've faced, I'm sure, conditions in which boards were just too involved in a company's day-to-day business. How did you manage through that dynamic?
I established a personal relationship with all of them, understood what it is that they wanted. You know, how did they want the information? How much information did they want? What format did they want it in? And I just, I made sure that I got that to them in between the board meetings, because when they got to the board meetings, I wanted no surprises. So even though they wouldn't know exactly what you were going to be saying, David, or what Jim would be saying, or Julie, or whatever it is, I had already prepped them on the things that were working, the things that were not working, concerns that I had. But again, it goes back to the style of that investor. How much information did they want? When did they want it? How did they want it? All that other kind of stuff. So I spent a lot of my time working them individually to make sure that the board meetings went the way that they went. And I do that even with my clients. I had a situation with one of my clients where there was an investor that was just coming in and, you know, wrecking the board meeting. I mean, taking control of the board meeting and going down these rabbit holes and whatever. And I was able to coach that CEO in terms of the things to do in order to put that board person back in their seat.
Thank you. Do you subscribe to the notion that it's more commonplace for companies to reach stages of scaled growth in which they just inevitably outlive the capabilities of many of their executives, including the founding CEO?
Yeah, well, there's that famous saying, what got you there won't get you, no, what got you here won't get you there.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. And it absolutely is true, right? And there are different levels, especially when you get to $8 to $10 million, a lot of companies get stuck there. And a lot of times it is because of people, and you as a CEO, you need to be on top of that, you know, to making sure that you've got the, you know, the right people in place in order to scale. And even the CEO themselves, right, of how far can you take it? I mean, that requires a lot of maturity to know that, okay, maybe you can take a company to, you know, 20, 30 million, but maybe you can't get that company to 50 million and above.
Are you, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, because it makes me think of, I think one of your most recent blogs where you talk about the culture renovation by Kevin Oakes. And I was really intrigued by this, but I have to tell you, I'm always skeptical, and I'm sure you probably are too, when you see another book claiming that, hey, and there's a 10-step process to the promised land. What was it about this particular book that inspired you? Because I feel like it applies to kind of how you were answering that question there and the changes that happened.
Yeah, to me, it was the level of study that they did, right? I mean, the thousands of companies and looking at the data and looking to see, you know, where did the data match? What were the correlations and all that other kind of stuff? So, yeah, I don't like those 17 steps to to whatever it is.
Yes, yes.
It's like, I'm good for about five.
yeah, me too.
yeah.
In this
but, one, yeah. It really was they are a research company.
Yeah.
So it was really the research that they did and the validation that they did and that really got my attention.
Yeah. And then I think I like these, in your case, it's a series, right? You really help the reader kind of get here's the quick version of what you're going to take away from this. So I was intrigued. I read through it and was like, okay, I have to get a copy of this book so I can learn more about this whole cultural renovation.
Yeah. And it's a timely book, right? I mean, it's one of the questions that David asked. I mean, the employers are looking for what's the culture of this company. And it's really important that you know, it has a good culture.
Yeah, even more important with this younger generation coming into the workforce.
In fact, further to that point, I would suggest that employees like to see a executive team kind of look like them as well. Do you find you're more deliberate in pressing your clients to make sure they have a diverse mix of leaders on their leadership team? And if so, why is that important?
Well, I don't go in to have that conversation just to have that conversation, right? I mean, if they've got, I'm a true believer, if they've got A players, then you need to give those A players the opportunity to continue to be an A player. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But yeah, when it does come time for change, you know, we do have those conversations about, you know, what are they looking for? And how does it fit within the, you know, the makeup of the employee group, you know, diversity and so forth. So it does become, you know, it does become a conversation, but it only becomes a conversation if an executive kind of is loose in the socket and it looks like, you know, change is inevitable.
Yeah. I've just come to find over the years that leaders who try to hire, this is obvious stuff, other leaders who kind of think and act like them, that this sort of shared view of the world limits the advantage of other worldviews and other challenging observations that you will never have the advantage of seeing and understanding. And that's where you get to the more creative solutions, right? Because, hey, I never thought of it that way. Thanks for bringing that forward, right? And, you know, if everyone looked and acted and thought the same way, you go down this narrow path of groupthink to get you to a conclusion.
I totally agree. I mean, this has been around forever, right? That the healthiest companies are able to have debates,
yeah,
right? And you're debating the ideology, not the personality.
Yeah.
and the only way that you have that is if you've got diversity and, you know, diverse opinions and coming from different walks of life and so forth.
Yeah, and in essence, this is along the lines of what you were talking about earlier, is that leaders should speak last. They should have that humility. They should look to others to kind of have room to offer their expertise and perspectives.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's also a gift that if a leader, you know, speaks last or doesn't answer a question and says, okay, well, Chris, well, what do you think? You just asked me the question, what would you do? You do that enough. And then it's like, Chris, look, I just want to point out to you that for the past half a dozen times, I've 100% agreed with everything that you would have done. So just go do it. Yeah. You know, feel empowered, right? And Chris is going to be like, wow. So, you know, part of that of the CEO having humility and speaking last, and it also becomes a gift, you know, if it's done properly.
Yeah, I often will talk to leaders about the fact that if they walk into a room and the energy doesn't feel right, or it's not gelling, something isn't comfortable, I tell them, like, they're mostly responsible for the climate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
We've got a few more questions left, but one question I do want to make sure that I ask you, I'm curious about, especially for those listeners that I know are going to go to your website at burstgrowth.com. You talk a lot about the scaling up approach, which is a new for me, a new approach. Could you talk to us a little bit about what that is and why that is an approach you use?
Yeah, it's so when I decided that I wasn't going to be a CEO anymore and I wanted to go coach executive teams, I wanted to have, and in fact, I was having the conversation with David when I was first getting going, I wanted to have some kind of a framework that I could fall back on. So, I mean, I looked at a number of them. I looked at Vistage, which is a great framework. I landed on scaling up because it really spoke to me. And the author, Vern Harnish, his whole premise is that it doesn't matter what industry it is, you have to get four decisions right: people, strategy, execution, and cash. Now, we all know that I really wish it was only four decisions, right? But think of those things as four spinning plates. And sometimes a plate might drop on the floor. Sometimes two plates might drop on the floor. But if you always come back to people, have I created an environment where people want to get out of bed in the morning and come to work, right? That right. Strategy, do I have some kind of a sustainable competitive advantage as it's showing up in my revenue growth? Because for the most part, if you have the right strategy, you're going to be growing. Execution is all about discipline and profitability. So are you generating industry-leading profits? And if not, why not? And then cash is, do you growth sucks cash. So do you have enough cash to fuel your growth? But what I find interesting as a business coach is, I don't care what the industry is. I don't go in as a consultant, because they're a subject matter expert in an industry. I go in as a business coach. I'm a subject matter expert on how to help them scale, getting people, strategy, execution, and cash right. So to finish that sentence, it doesn't matter what the industry is. Everybody has issues related to people, strategy, execution, and cash. And the great thing that Vern Harnish did is that it's not the gospel according to Vern. He went out and got used from thought leaders, Jim Collins, Pat Lencioni, you know, Stephen Covey. I used to say to my kids, it was a greatest hits, you know, CD. And they say, Dad, what's a CD?
Whoops. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you know, you're aging yourself as you say, you know, I think years ago I burned a CD on that. And of course, if the younger person in your midst says, so you actually, you know, set a, but what is the CD and you put it on fire? What are you talking about?
Yeah. So I think the genius of Vern is it's not what he thinks. It's what thought leaders in people and strategy and execution and in cash think. And then that material changes probably 10-15%, you know, on an annual basis, because things do change. And that's what resonated with me the most. I only wish that I knew about that. I knew about this process when I was running my companies, because I see how much easier it is for the companies that I coach to scale. In fact, that when I first read the book, when I decided that I was going to get certified, I put the book down about 25% through and I got depressed thinking about if I only knew.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But well, that is really helpful. And it also fits with, you know, what I always think is so important, which is that model of evidence-based coaching, which is the whole concept of being based on theory and real practice, real research, and not, not some made up experiences that a few consultants learned along the way. So that's helpful.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you, what's the theory behind, back to burstgrowth.com. This is where our listeners can find you. The headline on your website is Burst Consulting is your catalyst for freedom. So tell us more about freedom in this context.
Yeah. So the saying, freedom sets you free. Probably some rock and roll legend saying that, right? A Woodstock or something like that.
Yes.
but it's true, right? I mean, think about it. If you play an instrument, the first time you pick up the instrument, right? It's clunky. Your body position is probably clunky, your hands or whatever it is. But the more you practice and practice and practice, you just sit down and you play. Freedom's, you know, it's such... The discipline of doing it, of having the freedom, it just sets you free. So to me, it's all about the discipline of learning how to scale your company. And the more you practice that and the more you follow that discipline, it just sets you free to whatever it is that you want, whatever your freedom is. When I would go into CEOs and I said, well, what's your freedom? I'll never forget. One of them said, well, I want to be able to take 2 weeks vacation in a row. And then come back and know that the company's still there. Right. So to that was that particular CEO's freedom. Right. So.
That's good. How they define it. And it is defined very differently depending on what stage the company is at and where the leader's at.
Yeah. So I would say freedom sets you free. It's discipline. Following the discipline, it sets you free. It gives you the freedom to do whatever it is you want to do.
I would suggest with all the learnings now under your belt that you've been set free to have the confidence to be able to help others because you come from a learned place. You have fewer blind spots. That's the beauty of well-informed, experienced leaders who now give back in the manner that you are through Burst Growth. That CEOs are fortunate to be able to find you. Like you were fortunate to find Jimmy all those years ago, Jimmy Tribig. They can now find you for but you probably don't do this for free. That's where free and freedom ends for you, right? There's a modest charge for what you offer, but it's worth it.
It's absolutely worth it. I mean, the results that that companies get, I get great pleasure out of it. But I also want to say though that I'm a continual learner. So one of the reasons why I went scaling up is because on an annual basis I have to get recertified, and in order to get recertified I have to attend leadership conferences, right, and put hours in. So I love that, right, because you don't just get to a place and then you're done.
Boy, that's quite the discipline. So this certification requires an annualized recert.
Yeah.
Annualized, that's impressive.
Yeah, recertification. But that's what I wanted, right? It forces us to stay current. And like that blog that I'm writing right now, right? Hearing him speak, it really resonated with me doing some research. And it's like, okay, I want to write about this thing. So, yeah, it's great to get to a certain level of expertise. They used to say have gray hair. We don't have hair. I think we look better that way.
I've ascended beyond gray.
Right? Yes.
But it doesn't stop. Your learning cannot stop. So just as I require, my clients to be continual learners, I do the same thing.
I was inspired by the success story about working with Student Loan Hero on your site. So that was encouraging.
Yeah, that was phenomenal. That was a phenomenal outcome for them. Yeah.
So our closing segment we like to do on our show is a multiple choice question. We call this segment the Choose Your Trap. So there's really no good option, but we're going to give you a multiple choice here. All right. So here's the scenario and here's your choices. Or you can choose whatever you want to do, but here's the choice. And this is a real situation that I've had a conversation with a leader about recently. You're working with a CEO of a recently acquired company, and she comes to you for advice. And here's your options that she's presenting herself with and giving to you, which is A, you know, do I adopt the acquiring company's management practices, which I may not really don't agree with? B, do I just resist and defend the management practices that got us where we are today? And I know they work. Or C, do I just run for the exit as fast as possible?
Let's not C. So I've been just acquired.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you've got the big company coming in and saying, hey, this is how we like to run things. You need to do it our way.
Or so I'm not allowed to ask, why in the heck didn't I ask those questions during the delivery?
Yeah, there's a lot of context missing. But okay. In this case, I don't think they necessarily did.
Yeah. You know what? I guess. So, okay, what would I do? I think what I would do is, if I'm going to hit my numbers and I know my process works, I'm going to go with my process and deliver my numbers. And then if I get called on the carpet, say, okay, but I'm delivering my numbers. Why do we want to risk changing anything? So that I don't know if that was A or B, but that's what I would do.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like B. And I think this is always a tough spot for some of these companies that get acquired and going through that experience, right? I think it's tough. And a lot of times what I've found, and I've been on the other side in almost every case, that I find that it's a change management activity, right? How do you do this over time? How do you help evolve it? But it's very difficult for some of these companies to get bought.
And most likely it could become top down. They could say, I don't care. You're going to do it this way.
Yeah.
And then you have a decision of either do it or what was your option C?
Yeah. Yeah. And I find in this case, the leader is trying to hold the culture together of that team they brought in, and keeping that team together in that environment is really tough.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think it was Harvard Business Review this was decades ago, that said 80% of acquisitions never achieved a financial target because of a culture mismatch.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, most acquisitions fail, and you can point to that. In fact, I agree to the caveat that one or both of you placed on this, that context matters when it comes to the point of acquisition. Is it a fire sale, right? A company's just trying to limp to an exit. Or is this a highly successful company and the acquirer wants the secret sauce? They're buying the technology, the expertise, the revenue, the rich clientele. I mean, where are you on the spectrum of the conditions of the sale and the point in which cultures now come together in which that question arises, Chris, that you put to Rob? I would think context could lead to different outcomes because you're either leveraging strength of being acquired, or you have a lack of leverage when the acquirer says, we do things this way.
Yep.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Rob, thanks for sharing your wisdom, providing perspective. It's great to catch up with you in general. You're one of the true CEO mentors and leaders out there, I think, so people can find you at burstgrowth.com. And they have a chance to gain their freedom as a result of their work with you. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you, David. And thank you, Chris. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Rob.
Hey, thanks for listening. Do you know a leader who could benefit from hearing about the Leadership Trap? Well, we hope you will share this podcast with them. And remember, give the podcast a 5-star rating. Every rating helps us reach more leaders. You can find us at theleadershiptrap.org. Okay, we'll see you next time. Until then, stay out of those traps.